1.
Blog Talk Radio.
Rolling. Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and tonight we'll have a discussion on the Enoch Syndrome. Now, this is a term that we have applied to a particular type of channeled visionary right brain revelation that is extraordinarily detailed and consistent. Now, the biblical Enoch was really the starting point of all of this. And in Enoch and his tour of heaven, that's where we're going to start off. And then we're going to proceed through Dean Kelly and OWASP and Philos. That's the dweller around two planets. We'll talk about the Urantia book and Richard Shaver, Edgar Cayce. We'll mention the Seth material, and finally, we will conclude with an article by the famous psychiatrist Robert Lindner, who wrote Rebel Without a Cause, and his story about the jet-propelled couch, which is quite interesting in this regard. And this was the inspiration for the film K-Pax, which some of you may have seen. Now, although we're going to examine the psychological factors behind this phenomenon, well, we're not out to debunk these fascinating revelations, but rather to place them in a perspective of Hermetic philosophy as a personal reality that extends to encompass the universe and is therefore real in its own context. And I said, join us and expand your consciousness. Well, this certainly is. Maybe we won't expand your consciousness, but my gosh, we will extend it. This is a fun subject. This is a lot of fun. And we have a lot of ground to cover. So first, what I want to do is I want to explain what our criteria is a little better here. There are any number of thousands and thousands and thousands of inspired works, lots of inspired works. What we're going to try to do is to concentrate on works that are revelatory in the sense that they're delivered in, they're written out when the author is in a state of trance. Some of them are done by automatic writing. They're works that are not contrived. These are works that just come flowing out of the author without hesitation, and they're very detailed, and they're very consistent, and they describe the history of the world, or the prehistory of the world, the revelation, the workings of heaven, and all these various things. The particular thing that characterizes these works is that they are revelatory. Now, with that in mind, well, let's start back with the Bible now. Probably you guys remember the the Scopes Monkey Trial. I don't know. You weren't there, but I mean, you've heard about it. And poor William Jennings Bryan was asked by Clarence Darrow. He said, "Well, do you really believe that God created the world in 7 days and 6 days and the rest of them? What's a day?" And Bryan said, "Well, really, the day could be any length." And at that point, his whole argument fell apart because a day could be any length, then evolution could be true. See, so the literal interpretation of the Bible is something that fundamentalists still cling to. Fundamentalists of all biblical religions still cling to this literal interpretation. So, that being said, one of the sources, one of the original sources of these later revelatory works are two parts of birth. Three parts of the Bible. One is Genesis, the creation story of Genesis, and then another one is the Book of Daniel, and finally, of course, the one we all know and love, the Book of Revelations. So these three revelatory works they've had a lot of influence on post biblical revelatory works. Now let me just get you started here. If we have any fundamentalists listening, this is something you got to believe now. This is chapter 6 of Genesis. "And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and the daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God," that's the sons of God now, not the Son of God, "the sons of God," Elohim, "saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them as wives, all of which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh. And yet his days shall be 120 years. And there were giants in the earth in those days. And also, after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, they bare children to them. The same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown." Oh, boy. Now, that's Genesis. That's the Word of God. That's, you got to believe that. I mean, you know, that's the Word of God. You got to believe it. And that had, of course, a tremendous influence on these later, a lot of these later revelatory works, especially revelatory works that have influenced occultism. Now, that's Genesis, but behind that is another book that is not really apocryphal. It just got lost, and that's the Book of Enoch. And the Book of Enoch goes on to describe the fallen angels, the sons of God, the Elohim, which, by the way, is plural. And it goes on to describe all 200 of them. Samyazah was their leader, and down they came, and the various ones taught various different things to the daughters of men whom they married and had children with, and they taught metallurgy, and they even taught women how to make themselves up. Then Enoch, the prophet who was describing all of this, he ascended to heaven, and the archangels gave him a lecture on how the whole cosmos worked, and they took him around, showed him everything, all the planets revolving and everything working, and then he came back down and had a few more adventures, and then instead of dying, Enoch was bodily taken up, He was raptured, if you will. Anyway, he was taken on up, and so his book got lost for years and years and years, and finally we didn't recover it really, and the full version of it, until 1730 something, 1733, something like that. A Scottish adventurer by the name of James Bruce, sort of an early day Indiana Jones, he went to Ethiopia and tramped around Ethiopia and got into one of these Ethiopian monasteries. Now, I got to mention something here that some of our black listeners will appreciate. Ethiopia is one of the oldest civilized nations on earth, and it's kind of the Tibet of the Western world. And they had these monasteries, some of them hidden in caves down in these gorges and all. And they had the manuscripts that they're so ancient that they go back to the days of the Queen of Sheba and everything. And they had copies of the original Book of Enoch, Man of the Coptic, of course. And James Bruce, he grabbed a couple of copies of the Book of Enoch and got them out of Ethiopia and took them back to England. Well, the Coptic priests were so upset about this that they chased him all the way back to England, trying to kill him. I mean, this was a real adventure story. It's a real Indiana Jones kind of adventure story. They got the Books of Enoch back, and eventually they got translated. But now, you want to ask the question about the Book of Enoch, and you say, well, didn't Dee and Kelly have Enoch the Book of Enoch when they did Enochian, when they had their Enochian transmissions? And that was in Queen Elizabeth's time. No, they didn't. In fact, Dee and Kelly, all they knew was they knew there was a Book of Enoch, but they didn't have it. And so they decided to do their own. So they, using Kelly, of course, as the scryer, and Dee as the magician, and they contacted the angels, and the angels delivered to them a complete language and all these marvelous and somewhat frightening Enochian calls and keys. This is a whole corpus over about 5 years' work that they did, and a tremendous system of magic. But it doesn't really, in other words, as I say, they did their own Enochian thing. By the way, when we published Book H, which is the Golden Dawn's secret Enochian document, we published this in the Seventh Ray back in 99. And some people said, oh, well, you left off the prologue. Well, somebody had stuck into Book H originally when it was written back in the early 1700s. They stuck in some kind of prologue to it that had nothing whatsoever to do with it, with Enoch. It was just a Garden of Eden thing. It had nothing, and it was really, really not germane at all. And some Golden Dawn chapters decided to just leave it out. Well, I think they were wise in doing that. So our particular version of the Book H does not have that little prologue. I think I'm going to publish it later. I'll publish it probably later just to show you what it is. But our version of the Book H is much more complete than what Skinner has in his Book One Rudd. Anyway, but this is a side issue. The point being with Enochian is that the language of the angels was generated out of Edward Kelly's subconscious, and yet it has a syntax and a grammar, and it is a complete, translatable, speakable, writable language. In fact, my little revelation thing that I did during my Holy Guardian Angel retreat, I got the Ten Laws of Atlantis, which related to each sphere of the Tree of Life in Enochian. So that was my little contribution to And we use those, of course, in Beyond Lemuria. Now, one of the things about this visionary type experience is that it should be in some form of trance. It should be in some form of magical trance, or it can be while you're asleep. You know, Edgar Cayce, which we'll discuss later in a little bit, he delivered his revelations while he was asleep. One of the things about the revelatory process of the poet, Robert Graves, whose White Goddess is not exactly a revelatory work, but the White Goddess certainly is an inspired work, and it's very mysterious in the way it's written. However, Robert Graves, who was, while he was alive, he was the greatest living poet in the English language, he said that a poet can only sustain the spiritual inspiration for, I forget what exactly the amount of space that Graves allotted to that, but basically the poet could only sustain it for three or four pages, and after that he has to start switching primarily to the left brain. And that was Graves' theory. So that is if you're not completely in a trance. Now, let's talk about revelatory works that occurred after Dean Kelly. We have to look at the Book of Mormon briefly. The Book of Mormon, as many of you know, is a delivered work. Joseph Smith claimed that he got these special glasses, kind of like 3D glasses, actually. They were the Urim and the Tulum, he said. And those are the two stones that are on the breastplate of the high priest in ancient Israel. But he claimed they were sort of colored glasses, kind of like, as I say, kind of like 3D glasses. And this is back in 1830. And this was before the Rosetta Stone was discovered. And he claimed that these books were in Egyptian hieroglyphics, golden plates that he discovered. And he was allowed to look at these golden plates with these magic glasses. And he translated the Book of Mormon this way. And obviously this is a trance state revelatory kind of thing. And this is all the lost tribes of Israel running around in the United States with chariots and being very biblical and whatever, and of course using bronze weapons and what have you, which kind of the archaeologists look askance at this, naturally. But the thing about this is that this was before the Rosetta Stone was deciphered. And at that time, the time that Smith did this, one cartouche of Egyptian writing was supposed to, according to the theory, represent about a paragraph or at least a long sentence of content. Well, as it turns out, after the Rosetta Stone was deciphered, it turns out one cartouche is one word, Not a whole sentence or a whole paragraph. So consequently, it would have taken three or four wagon loads of golden plates to do all of this. But regardless of that, this is Smith obviously did this thing in some form of trance, and he obviously believed it. Of course, somebody also said that there was a novel published a few years before that was kind of like it. But, you know, no, Smith really did. He really did believe this. And he was a good Mason, good Freemason, and so consequently, you know, we got to give him credit for that. He really believed what he was doing, and that's the Book of Mormon. And then a little bit after that, while in the later 1800s, along comes a dentist, who was a bit of a mystic, and he did an incredible work called the OWASPE Bible. And this big thing, this is about 1,000 pages long, and it's a great big huge doorstopper of a book, which he did by automatic writing. And he did it automatic writing by hand and by his typewriter. He also did lots of illustrations, had his own hieroglyphic language, and this thing is just, OWASPE is fascinating because it's almost psychedelic. It's the biggest mishmash of biblical and mythological word salad that it's entertaining to read it because it is so incredible in the way it mixes mythology up. Thor is a son of Jehovah, and Baal and Astarte are both enemies, and he describes the whole planetary, incredible new planetary systems, goes back, you know, way back before the flood, and it's almost as if what he did was he read the Bible, and then he read Wolfensch's mythology. And then he took a lot of LSD, because he didn't have LSD then. But that's the way it's like. It's like Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Wake in mythological terms. And OWASPE is just delightful. But it's got to be revelatory. But it's really, really, it's not very consistent. And you have to kind of look at it from a standpoint of, I'm not going to call it an entertainment. Let's say there's value in it, but yeah, that's just really, really something. Anyway, then, after that, we can move right along to another very interesting one, which we made some use out of, and that is A Dweller on Two Planets by Frederick Spencer Oliver. And this came around started about 1885, and Oliver was a young kid about 17 years old, and his Shasta, Mount Shasta, was complete wilderness at that time. His father had a mining claim up there and sent the kid out to stake out the claim, and he was overwhelmed by the spirit of Philos, this Atlantean adept who came down from the mountain and told him that he was going to be the scribe for Philos's book that Philos wanted him to write, and they're going to do an automatic writing. Now, this started off the whole Mount Shasta, Atlantis, Lemuria thing. It started right there with Philos. So what Oliver did, and eventually around 1900 he published it, was this great big long, it's kind of a novel, but it's definitely a delivered work. David, you can make criticisms of it. You can say that, well, he obviously read Theosophy. He obviously read Blavatsky. He obviously read Donnelly's Atlantis. There's even some trade unions in Atlantis that are very much like the beginning of the trade union movement around about the time Oliver was writing this thing. So there are things, criticisms you can make, but Philos, Dweller on Two Planets is still a remarkable work. And then let's talk about Blavatsky for a little bit, seeing as how she came along around a little bit before Dweller on Two Planets with Isis Unveiled, and then, of course, a few years later, The Secret Doctrine. Now, we can't call this neither of these books actually fit into the category we're talking about, because granted, Blavatsky was a spiritualist medium, she was a mystic, she was a seeress in a lot of ways, but these books are not consistently, they're not one great big revelation. They're a whole bunch of little revelations that are tied together with a lot of left brain commentary and extrapolations or whatever. So she's writing these things. You can't tell where the inspiration is, the inspiration and the calculation. You can't differentiate between the two. So consequently, they don't quite fit into our category. But the secret doctrine, especially, this had a tremendous, tremendous influence on Western occultism. And in fact, it was a combination. What it did was it was an attempt to synthesize Eastern occultism with Western occultism, primarily emphasis on the Eastern, whereas Isis Unveiled had been more on the, you know, more dealing with the Egyptian and the Western. But a couple of things I want to point out about Blavatsky that you should be aware of is that she tried to place her secret masters in Tibet. She placed them in Tibet. That was Kutumi and Murya, the two hidden or ascended masters that she was in contact with. Well, now, this always disturbed me because I studied Tibetan Tantric Buddhism at some length, and I spent a year actually practicing it with the Sakya Order, and I've read all the Evans Wentz material and whatever, and I had about 8 Tantric initiations, and I knew that what Blavatsky was talking about was not Tibetan Tantric Buddhism, and it wasn't Bunpo, and it just wasn't. So this made me, I tended to look at Blavatsky, look askance at most of what she was saying, because I thought, well, gee, if she's passing this off as Tibetan Buddhism, it certainly isn't. Well, as it turns out, a scholar, K. Paul Johnson, by the way, wrote a book a few years back which really kind of pulled the lid off of this whole thing and showed it for what was really going on, if you accept his theory. And this book's called The Masters Revealed. Now, what Johnson established to his satisfaction was that Blavatsky's sponsors in India, who supposedly bankrolled her to quite a extent, were the Maharaja of Kashmir and his brother-in-law, both of whom were Sikh Sant gurus. In other words, they were holy men. And yet they were not ascended. They were both very much alive. But they were definitely Sikh Sant gurus, both of them. And Sikh Sant, by the way, for those of you who don't, you know, quite realize this, it was a later religion that developed in among the Sikhs. In around about 1500, which incorporated aspects of Hinduism, aspects of Buddhism. And it was very very spiritual, very mystical. And this, but it's not Tibetan Buddhism, not by a long shot. And it's not that it isn't good in its own right. It's very fine, but it's not Tibetan Buddhism. Now, what these two gurus, insisted that Blavatsky move their venue to somewhere outside of British control, and Tibet was the logical place, and claim that they were from, so they could deliver their teachings through her, which, of course, she had to do, because, of course, they were sponsoring her, and Lord Cromer was, he had whatever the British Raj counterpart for MI5 was, they were following Blavatsky's every move because they thought she was a Russian agent. And so the Maharaja and his brother-in-law, they realized that they were anti-Christian, and so was Blavatsky. So they realized that they had to be writing from Tibet under assumed names, and that was the only way they could get their teachings across safely. So they did. And Blavatsky had these things falling in envelopes, falling through the smoky rafters of the ceiling and floating down, and she's taking them in trance and all that. And this was here again to protect the identities of these people. Well, after I found that out, I got a whole new appreciation of theosophy. Theosophy got a lot of really, really valuable, good concepts and things in it. Even Leadbeater, who has a bad reputation in some ways, Leadbeater was a terrific psychic, and so was Annie Besant. So I've taken a new look at theosophy as a result of K. Paul Johnson's revelation, and it really is got a lot of valuable material in it, but still you can't call this a revelatory work, because you don't know where the revelation is, where the contrivance is, and what's floating down in envelopes from the ceiling, and who's supposed to be at the Tibet and who's not, so it's really, you can't. But it had a tremendous influence. I mean, it really did, and certainly valuable. Now, let's talk about Urantia for a minute. Urantia. Yes, I know you've all seen this. It's a great big blue book. It's not the same size as a WASP, big blue book, and it purports to be a delivered work that comes all the way from and details the history of the universe, the whole universe, by the way. From way back in long before the flood, back 50,000 years or so ago, and more, and all the way back to the beginning of the universe, and it was originally received, or however you want to put it, it was originally received in the 1930s. Now it's a rather mysterious situation. There's only one man that we know of, and he's dead now, who was involved in this. But supposedly it was done by a committee of people, and there's any number of stories on how they did this and how they'd leave writing materials in a locked room or a locked vault, and then they'd come in and they'd find this stuff written down and by these various angels and what have you. And there's all kinds of stories about it, but there's only one guy, Sanders, who supposedly is known to have been one of the people that did it. A foundation was established, and after World War II, in 55, I believe, it was finally published. Now, Urantia is very interesting, but I want to point something out about it that I don't really think it's revelatory, or at least not completely revelatory, because it has different writing styles. It's supposed to be written by different people, and it has a very definite agenda, which OASP, by the way, does not have, and Philo's does not have. Urantia has an agenda, and Urantia the agenda of Urantia is to reestablish Christianity in the very modern age, where we know the vast extent of the universe, and we know all of we're aware of other planets and all this kind of stuff. And I think that Urantia was conceived and launched as a counter to a secret doctrine of Blavatsky and a counter to modern science. In other words, to reestablish Christianity in the terms of modern science and evolution. One of the things we want to point out here is, I should have pointed it out when I was talking about Blavatsky, and that is that Darwin's Origin of the Species, that this is, well, Scopes Monkey Trial, we mentioned that. Darwin's Origin of the Species back in the 1800s kicked the props out from under fundamental Christianity and fundamental biblical interpretation. It made the Bible seem like a kind of a Bishop Usher's idea that you know the world started 4,000 years ago at 2:30 in the afternoon. You know, I mean, it just kicked that that became a kind of a quaint little fuddy-duddy thing. And I mean, evolution stretched the human condition way back, you know, millions of years, whatever. So, Blavatsky offered a super evolution, and that was definitely influenced by Darwin. She offered a super evolution, but the secret doctrine was, if anything, anti-Christian. Now, Urantia comes along, and it offers pretty much the same thing, but it's super-Christian. So I think that there's a certain amount of contrivance involved in Urantia. And if you like Urantia, you know, a lot of people like it. A lot of people think it's great, but I think there is that contrivance there. Now, moving on from Urantia, let's talk about Edgar Cayce for a minute. Edgar Cayce was the sleeping prophet back in the 20s, and he would this whole idea of some people delivering, talking in their sleep and delivering these things. This is a very definite factor. Now, question nobody. I don't know whether anybody ever figured out, was Cayce in a REM state? Or was he in deep sleep? This is a very interesting question. Because if he was in a REM state, that's dream, you know, the dream state, then he's obviously influenced by his own, you know, his own psychic, because we know that the dream state, when you're in the REM state, you're kind of working out your own problems in psychologically, one thing or another. That would influence. Or is this coming from the deep sleep state into the dream, into the REM state? How is this working? Or if he's in a deep state of sleep, in which there is no dreaming, and then he could just become a transmitter. We're not sure of that. Now, Kenneth Grant pointed out something rather interesting that stuck in my mind. Where does the consciousness go in the deep sleep state? You know, consciousness, you're conscious you're conscious when you're in the REM state. But where does your consciousness go when you're in the deep, deep sleep? Well, of course, L. Ron Hubbard wrote a science fiction, well, a fantasy story, actually, called The Slaves of Sleep, where people, during their deep sleep state, they were slaves in another dimension, and they had to break free. This is a good story. But you wonder, you know, where does the consciousness go when you're in a deep sleep state? Anyway, Cayce delivered all sorts of diagnoses, which turned out a lot of cases to be true, and for various people in different parts of the country. And he also delivered a great deal of information about Atlantis, ancient Atlantis, and when he was in this sleep state. Cayce, that material, it seems like it might be valid. Now, come along to one of my favorites, Richard Shaver. Richard Shaver, and this Shaver, as some of you may know, Shaver was the guy that was hearing the Darrows down underground through his welding torch when he was working for Ford Motor Company, and he was an arc welder, and he was hearing through his welding torch, the solenoid, he was hearing these voices from down in the caverns where they were torturing beautiful women to death and all this kind of kinky stuff. Anyway, Shaver started writing, converting these visions of his, these horrendous visions and these visions of the elder gods flying through space, going from star to star and settling the earth and digging all these caverns. It was kind of really, really wild stuff. He started converting these visions of his into science fiction stories for Palmer's Amazing Stories magazine back in the 1940s. And he and Palmer got a lot of people to believe in them. Now, Shaver himself was a schizophrenic, and he absolutely swore up and down that he had physically been in these underground caverns where the ancient survivors of Atlantis and Lemuria had all this machinery that they could read people's minds with and drive people insane with and everything else, including Shaver. And a large following of people believing this, reading Amazing Stories. Now, this was back in the middle 40s and even into the early 50s. But the point I want to make on Shaver is that Shaver was very much influenced by a fantasy writer by the name of Abraham Merritt. And I mentioned last week, I said we're due for a Merritt revival. Abraham Merritt was the professional journalist, very successful. He was the editor of the American Weekly, which was the most popular newspaper supplement, Sunday supplement, in the country. And Merritt wrote these fantasies for fun. He didn't write it for money. But they were beautiful fantasies, and they involved lost races, survivors of Atlantis and Lemuria. One of them, the Moon Pool, which influenced Shaver, was set out in Non-Medola on the Pacific. And Shaver was very much influenced by Merritt, and Shaver thought that Abraham Merritt was writing the truth. And he even said so. I mean, he thought these fiction stories were true. Well, now, you know, you kind of realize that some of these fiction tales, they seem visionary. Fiction tales like Merritt's Moon Pool and Face of the Abyss, and stories like this, will have an effect on people who are visionary, like Shaver, and they could also, like Philo's, Spencer Oliver, when he was a young man, he read Blavatsky and he read Donnelly's Atlantis, and who knows what the dentist who wrote, I think the dentist who wrote Owosby, I think it, like I said, he, that's a shuffle up of the Bible and Bullfinch's mythology. I think you shuffle the two together and mix them up, and you pretty much get the Owosby book. Now, along after this, in the 1960s and 70s, there came along a series of similar revelations called the Seth material, and that was very, very detailed. And now we're going to get around to the one that gives us the chance really to kind of dig in and find out what the psychodynamics behind this sort of thing could be. Now, I remember when we started off, I said we were going to deal with the jet-propelled couch by the psychiatrist Robert Lindner. That's Lindner. Now, Lindner was, most famous for writing The Rebel Without a Cause, which became of course, the source of the James Dean film. But the jet-propelled couch was a case that he had that he wrote up, and I kind of, he fictionalized it a little bit, but essentially it's true. This was during World War II, and he got assigned by the Defense Department to go to Los Alamos, where they were, Oppenheimer and the general were building the bomb, you know. And Los Alamos, by the way, if you've ever been there, it's a totally isolated place on top of a mesa. There's only one road going up. And so he goes there, and he has a special assignment. Now, the special assignment is that they have an atomic physicist, a young man, who he calls in the story Kirk Allen. And this young man is having some sort of an aberration which is affecting his work, and they want to see if Linder can get him out of it. And so what he discovers when he starts sessions with the young scientist is that Kirk Allen is, during his sleeping state, and here again we don't know, and Linder doesn't say whether it's REM or whether it's deep sleep, during his sleeping hours, Kirk Allen has become a galactic emperor. He is off at off of the other end of the galaxy, and he's a galactic emperor, and he's running the galaxy. And so every night when Kirk hits the pillow, he falls asleep, and then he becomes a galactic emperor. Now, he wakes up the next day, and instead of doing his work in the lab and in the office and all that, he spends the rest of the, most of his time writing notes about his galactic empire. And of course, this is affecting his work, and this is disturbing and very disturbing to the, Oppenheimer and the rest of them. So they want Linder to try to get him out of this. And so Linder decides that the best thing he can do is to get into, because Kirk Allen is totally convinced that he really is a galactic emperor, at least at night. And so Linder decides to get in it with him. Now, those of you who have seen KPAX, you can probably see where this is going. So anyway, Linder starts with the idea that he will, just like in KPAX, that he will be able to show inconsistencies in this, and he will be able to show Kirk Allen that really this just doesn't hold water, thinking he can do that. And it turns out, of course, that he can't, because the Galactic Empire is very well worked out. And in fact, it's rather remarkably well worked out. And so Linder, and the more Linder gets involved in it, the more they try to debunk it, the more fascinated Linder becomes by it, and they start diagramming this thing, and they start collecting all these notes, and they start going into this thing. And now, let me point something out, though, that about Kirk Allen that bears on our subject. Kirk Allen, according to the story, was raised on a South Pacific island with no companions, no other children, and he was raised by an Irish nanny who would not permit him to masturbate, yet seduced him constantly, but would not permit him to masturbate. So little Kirk was raised in a very strange sexual situation where he had no sexual relief, and yet he was tantalized by his nanny, and he had all this sexual frustration. And so he was a virgin, and not only was he a virgin, he didn't have any other way to do it. And yet he was a genius. Now, he was reading science fiction, too, and I think that, of course, has something to do with it. Now, Linder doesn't mention, but I can imagine that that Kurt Hallam was probably reading Edmund Hamilton, who was the inventor of the Galactic Empire, and certainly E.E. Smith, Doc Smith, who was a Ph.D., who wrote some of the first Galactic Empire stories. And so he was reading those, and so all of this sexual frustration and whatever and this business goes into his Galactic Empire idea that he's getting when he's asleep. And so finally, what happens in the story, and this is what's really amazing, is that all this goes on, and Linder gets fascinated, and because the science of this Galactic Empire is so good and so far out and at all, they can't debunk it, and Linder gets fascinated by it. And then, meanwhile, Kirk Allen meets a young woman in the laboratory, and he starts to have a real genuine love affair. And he's getting real genuine sexual relationship, finally. And as soon as this happens, the dynamic, the power starts deteriorating. The vision of the Galactic Empire at night starts to ease off. And pretty soon, but Linder is still fascinated by it. And so Kirk Allen starts playing along with Linder, even though he's starting to disbelieve it, his own vision. And finally, he just tells Linder, "Oh, come on now, this is not real. This is just something I've been making up." And Linder, at this point, has to wean himself off of it himself. He has to realize that, hey, he got caught up in this thing himself. And now, the difference here between this and K-Pax is that in K-Pax, when Pope finally decides that he's going to go back to K-Pax, well, after they've revealed his trauma that caused this situation and everything else, when he's supposed to go transition to K-Pax, actually goes into a catatonic state. And he stays in a catatonic state. That's it. And, you know, you think maybe that proves that Prote really didn't come from K-Pax or go to K-Pax. No, it doesn't at all, because this is what happened to Shaver. Shaver, when he thought he was in the caves, for 8 years, Shaver was in a mental institution, and much of that time he was in a catatonic state. So Shaver, in that sense, really was in the caves. And K-Pax, and Prote really did go back to K-Pax because he was in a catatonic. So that's the difference between the Kirk Allen story, of course, and K-Pax. But Shaver did actually go. Shaver was somewhat influenced by Jack London's Star Rover 2, in which you put prisoners in straitjackets, and the only way to beat the straitjacket is to go to another dimension. Get out. You know, get out and go to another world, which of course is Jack London's classic story there. So what we're looking at here is these revelations are the dynamics behind them. We can't say, even in the case of Kirk Allen, even in that case, maybe somewhere he really was a Galactic Emperor, you know. And even if he'd been reading Doc Smith and all, even so, yeah, maybe somewhere in these vast dimensions, the vast extent of the universe, maybe Kirk Allen really was a Galactic Emperor. Maybe Prote really did go back to K-Pax. You know? Maybe Shaver really was in the caves, wherever the caves are, you know. We said, you know, they're in another dimension. Shaver never would go along with that. Palmer kept trying to tell him that. No, these revelations and these revelatory works are very, very, very valuable. And you have to look at where they come from. Like Crowley's book, The Law, is revelatory work, no doubt. Just because it's revelatory work, that doesn't mean you have to follow it. But, I mean, it's a revelatory work. And yet, at the same time, it's influenced by the Call of the 30 Aethers. It's influenced by Rabelais' Gargantua. You can see things that influence it, but it's still a revelatory work, very definitely. The revelatory works, I think, should be realized for what they are. And I think Shaver, some of these other folks were probably correct when they assumed that Merritt and other writers had some truth to what they were saying. Because who knows? Who knows where Merritt got? We know Lovecraft got his ideas from his dreams. Where did Merritt get his ideas? And so these revelatory works, especially the revelatory ones, are very, very, very good. One thing I'm going to leave you with that I didn't mention before when it comes to revelatory works, and I got it right over here, that definitely, definitely revelatory, is Dion Fortune's Cosmic Doctrine. Now, this was about 1924, and the Cosmic Doctrine is very theosophical, it's kind of Alice Bailey-ish, but it is, the Cosmic Doctrine it's not entertaining, it's very technical, it's a remarkable work, it's all channeled, and you will not find anything in it that is going to insult your intelligence at all. Some of the problems with revelatory works like the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus Christ and various some of this Pelagian stuff, and unfortunately some of the Telos stuff from Shasta, this stuff it insults your intelligence. And the Cosmic Doctrine by Dion Fortune, this does not insult your intelligence. This challenges your intelligence. This is definitely delivered. Whereas a book like The Celestine Prophecy by Redfield, no, that's not a delivered work. It's inspired, yes, but it's not delivered. In fact, Redfield himself admitted that there was no Aramaic manuscript or anything behind it. He put it together, but he did a beautiful job. So there are inspired works, and then there are revelatory works. And you should kind of differentiate between the two if you can. Now, I will say that the Bible in some parts of the Bible are definitely revelatory. Well, of course, obviously the book of Revelations is. And obviously there are parts OWASP, as crazy as it is certainly revelatory. Your rancher, I don't think so. And that's my opinion. Okay, anyway, we're just about to wrap it up. I'll get out the next week's topic. We'll come out to everybody on the abstract, and we'll be back next week with another fascinating topic in our ongoing exposition of Hermetic science and Hermetic art. And until then, we'll see you, and good magic.